there. And so that's what happened with this. So I wanted to read this first because have you ever seen one of those movies where the opening scene is they're doing something really weird and you're like, why is this happening? And then the scene freezes and the narrator comes on and he's like, I bet you're wondering how I got here. And then the whole movie is leading up to that moment and then they finish the movie. Well, that's kind of what we're going to do today. Colby read that section for us from verses 10 through 13. And so we're going to read that whole section of David and Shemaiah, but then we're going to go back and we're going to learn why this is significant, why Shemaiah reacted the way that he did, throwing rocks, and why David, what he's thinking and why he reacted the way that he did. There's a lot to the story, I think, that you have to know the backstory before you can truly understand what is happening. But first, we'll begin in 2 Samuel chapter 16, beginning in verse 5. When King David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually, and he threw stones at David, and at all the servants of King David, and at all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you men of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord, the king? Let me go over and take off his head. But the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? Leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men were on the road, while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. So we have two main characters in this story, really. It's David and it's Shimei. And there's some kind of supporting people here with Abishai and David's mighty men and all his people. But there's two main people that I want to look at, being David and Shimei. So let's really dive into this backstory to see what they both were thinking. So we're going to start with Saul and Jonathan dying. In 1 Samuel chapter 31 and going into 2 Samuel chapter 1, we see the story of Saul and Jonathan and how they die. And we see David's reaction to this. And throughout this, we're going to kind of just go through the whole book of 2 Samuel leading up to this because it's all important. And so that we can understand what David is thinking when Shimei is hitting him with rocks. So Saul is killed in war. He's fighting with the Philistines and Jonathan is killed and Saul's sons are killed. And an archer hits Saul with an arrow. And Saul tells the person that's with him, the servant who's an Amalekite, to just go ahead and kill him. And so he does, to put him out of his misery. So this Amalekite in 2 Samuel chapter 1, he comes from Saul's camp, and he comes to report to David what has happened in war, that he asked the Amalekite to kill him. And so he did so in accordance with what Saul wanted. And he brings David Saul's crown and his armlet. And so David tears his clothes in agony. He and all his men wept for both of them, both for Jonathan, which is understandable. Like, David and Jonathan were friends, and they were brothers, and they were close. So he's weeping for Jonathan, but he was weeping also for Saul. And then David kind of takes a turn, and he says, how is it that you are not afraid to put your hand out against the Lord's anointed? He says, your blood be on your head, talking to that Amalekite. Now, the Amalekite, he did what Saul told him to do. And so why would David be so upset about this? In fact, he's so upset that he kills the messenger. He says for him to just go ahead and to be executed because he killed the Lord's anointed. And he says, the blood is on your hands and not mine. Doesn't that seem harsh considering he did what Saul wanted him to do? David, he didn't want to have anything to do with the death of Saul. If you remember when Saul was chasing David and trying to kill him, there's multiple times that David could have killed Saul. And each time he would say, like, I could have killed you, but I'm not going to be the one to kill the Lord's anointed. I don't want any part of that because that is God putting you in this place. And so when this man comes and he says that he killed the Lord's anointed, David's like, who are you to kill who God has put in this place? And so he kills the messenger. He doesn't want anything to do with the blood of Saul on his hands. He respected the fact that the Lord had anointed Saul into this position so much that he didn't want to be the one responsible for his death. We move on in 2 Samuel chapter 2 to the battle of Gideon. So the Lord, David is anointed king of Judah. This man Ishbosheth, who is in the house of Saul, the household of Saul, he is over all of Israel. We see that earlier in chapter 2. 7 years and 6 months pass between this and the battle of Gibeon. So we get into the battle of Gibeon, and Abner is like the main guy over Saul's army on one side of the pool, and then Joab is the main guy on the other side of the pool for the house of David. And they both have their servants and their warriors with them, and they both agree, how about we just let all of the other guys fight, and then Joab and Abner, we just won't get into battle. And so they're like, that's a good idea. And so that's what happens. And they kind of sit back and let all the other people go and fight. And it says that the house of David was winning greatly. In fact, I think it says that the house of David lost 10 or 12 soldiers, and the house of Saul lost 360 in this battle. So the house of David was much mightier and much greater, and they were winning. And so Abner begins to flee. Three of David's nephews were in the mighty men that were in David's army, and it was Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And so Asahel is chasing him. It says that he was swift as a gazelle when he was chasing Abner. And Abner tells him to stop. And he says, I can't kill you. How am I supposed to face your brothers if I am the one that kills you? And Asahel says, I'm going to keep going. Like, he doesn't stop. And so Abner stops, but he stops with the spear facing back, and he plunges it through Asahel so hard that it goes through Asahel, and Asahel dies. And so the rest of the house of David chase him, Joab and Abishai, and they keep going. And they keep going until Abner says, when are you going to stop chasing me? And they say, well, we're actually going to go all night until the morning, but because you asked, we'll just stop. Which is odd, but that's what happened. And so we'll keep going. Ishbosheth, he was the king of Israel. He's in the household of Saul. And Abner is serving Ishbosheth at this time. Saul is dead. And Ishbosheth accuses Abner of sleeping with one of Saul's concubines. So Abner gets really upset. He's like, after all that I've done for you in the household of Saul, and you would do this to me. You would give me this untrue accusation. And so he says, instead, I'm just going to go fulfill what God told David would happen. I'm just going to go work for David. And so he goes to visit David, and he wants to join David's army. And so David is okay with this, and he lets Abner join. He gets his wife back that he went and fought 200 Philistines for and paid Saul the dowry for his wife that he never got, Saul's daughter. So he gets his wife Michal back, and Abner joins David's army. Well, Joab, the brother of Asahel, who just died, hears about this, and he's really upset for fair reason. And he's upset with David for being so okay with this man who killed his brother being in David's army. So Joab hears about it, and he calls Abner back, and he kills Abner. In fact, he strikes him in the stomach just like his brother died, killing him just as his brother was killed. And so David hears about this, and he's upset. He mourns, and he tears his clothes, and he says, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner. Again, we have a member of the household of Saul dying, and David says, my hands are clean from this. I did nothing involving this. I did not kill someone in the household of Saul. He tells everyone, Joab and Abishai included, to tear their clothes and put on sackcloth so that they can mourn the death of Abner. It's almost a slap in the face a little bit, it seems like. But David is trying to get across, I am not a part of this. So the people tried to get him to eat, and he gets so upset. He says, do you not know that a great prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And toward the end of this section, he says, the Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. David's washing his hands clean for one, but he also doesn't want to punish anybody, especially in his family. Like he's not punishing any of them, even though they went against what he said to do. He says that he was gentle that day, and that he leaves it in the hand of God. And it makes me question, is he scared to punish his family? He's not, of course, scared to punish people. We see it all throughout the story of David, him punishing people that go against him and that he's battling against. But when it comes to his family, is he scared to punish them? So David once again makes his point clear that he is not responsible for the death of the people in the house of Saul. Well, Ishbosheth hears about Abner dying, and he gets depressed. I mean, it's kind of his fault that Abner went over there in the first place, right? And so Ishbosheth is upset, and it says that just everything was taken out of him, and he just lays in bed sad. And these two guys, who were relatively irrelevant to the story, they go into Ishbosheth's house, into his room, and kill him in his bed. And they cut off his head, and they bring the head to David and say, "Look, we killed King Ishbosheth. We have his head. Now you can be the king of Israel." And David is so upset that he kills them because he didn't want that to happen. And then he buries the head of Ishbosheth in the grave of Abner. Again, clearing himself. He doesn't want any part of the blood of the household of Saul. Well, David goes on to win some battles. He's a great king. He fought a lot of victories and he won. He brings the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem and his kingdom is going really well. So we kind of have the peak, I think, of his kingdom in 2 Samuel chapter 7. God talks to Nathan the prophet through a vision, and it's intended for David. And basically in this vision, he's saying that David had approached him about, approached God about building a temple for God, and God said that David isn't going to be the one in 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 3. He says because he's a man of war. David's got blood on his hands. And so he doesn't want David to build the temple. But he says, "You won't build me a house of cedar, but instead I will establish an eternal kingdom, and you, your family, will be in the throne always. For all time, your family will be the one that is on the throne of this eternal kingdom." And so he says, "Your throne shall be established forever." What an honor for David. His kingship is going great up to this point. God approves of him so much that he wants his family and his bloodline to be the king always, to be on the throne always. So David, of course, is grateful. And he prays a prayer of gratitude, thanking God for the blessing him in this way and for knowing his heart. He says, "Thank you for knowing the heart of your servant." So then David goes on and he blesses Mephibosheth. Well, in chapters 8 and 10, we see him winning victories. The Lord is helping David in every battle, helping him win against all of Israel's enemies, especially some really important ones like Edom and Ammon and Syria. Big countries that are against Israel, David is winning against because the Lord is with him. But in between chapters 8 and 10, we have this chapter in chapter 9 where David blesses Mephibosheth. This man, Mephibosheth, was Saul's grandson. He was the son of Jonathan, and he was lame. His feet didn't work, is what the Bible says. And so he was the rightful heir to the throne, technically, instead of David. But God took the throne away from the household of Saul and gave it to the household of David, and gave it to David. And so Mephibosheth, obviously, was not the king. Well, David goes to the house of the servant of Saul, Ziba. He goes to the house of Mephibosheth, he sees Ziba, and he asks if there was anyone there that actually deserved the throne, if it was actually anyone's rightful place to have that throne. And Ziba says, "Well, there's this guy, Mephibosheth, who was taken from the palace as a small child, and he is lame, but he's actually the rightful heir to the throne. And so Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, he comes before David, and David tells him that he will restore to him all that was Saul's, and that he will always eat at the table of David. And David says, "You will always eat at my table, and you can live in my palace, and I will take care of you and all that is yours." Mephibosheth, I'm going to have a hard time with names this morning. I'm just saying, there's a lot of them, and so just bear with me. Mephibosheth says, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" And we're going to see dead dog later on, and we've seen it in the past in 2 Samuel, but David, he could have killed Saul back when David was being chased by Saul. He could have killed Saul, and he says, "Why are you chasing a dead dog, a flea such as I?" He's basically putting himself in a lower position. It's a term of abasement. He is trying to show humility towards Saul, and so in this case, we have Mephibosheth, the grandson of Saul, saying, why are you showing regard for me, a dead dog such as I? He's trying to show humility towards David. So Ziba, Mephibosheth, and everything that belongs to him, they move into the king's palace, and David kept his promise. He respects the household of Saul. And then everything starts going downhill super fast. Chapters 11 and 12 is the story of David, Uriah, and Bathsheba. And I'm sure many of you know the story, but in case you don't, I'll give a brief overview. David should have been in battle with his troops. It was springtime, which is the time when kings should be fighting with their armies, but David was in his palace, so he's already somewhere that he shouldn't have been. And he sees Bathsheba on the rooftop, and so he wants to sleep with her, so he devises this plan to kill Uriah. So he tells Joab, his nephew, one of the mighty men and one of the leaders in his army, to carry out this plan. Uriah dies, and David brings in Bathsheba and sleeps with her. And it says that the thing that David did displeased the Lord. The man that was going to establish this eternal kingdom, well, that God was going to establish the eternal kingdom, but David was going to always sit on that throne of the eternal kingdom. This man is the one that killed Uriah and slept with Bathsheba and is now bearing a child. That seems not good. It seems wrong that David, the one who is supposed to be on the throne of the eternal kingdom, is doing this. So Nathan the prophet rebukes David for what he has done. David realizes his wrongs, and Nathan says, regardless of what you say or what you do at this point, your child's going to die. And there's two other really important things that Nathan says. He says, one, the sword will never depart from your house. And he says, two, I will raise evil against you out of your own home. There's going to be evil out of the house of what is supposed to be the eternal throne. Up to this point, almost everything that's happened so far to David has been positive. He's been a great king. God is with him. Like I've been saying, in 2 Samuel 7, God promised that his family, his bloodline, would always sit on the throne. And his kingdom was going really well. God was with him. And then David wanted more. And because of that, because of what happens with Bathsheba and Uriah, David lay down his face on the ground in pain because of his wrongs. And David laid on the ground for 7 days and he fasted. And people tried to bring him food and he didn't want food because he was fasting. He felt so bad for what was happening and he knew that the child was going to die. And so he's begging God to not let the child die, and the child does. The servants didn't even want to tell him. They were scared. I mean, there's kind of a pattern here of servants coming to tell David that someone had died and then David killing the servants. So I don't blame the servants for being scared about this, but they don't want to tell David. And David sees them muttering off to the side and he says, "Did my child die?" And they say, "Yes." This is a low point in David's life. It's a valley. David is in anguish and he's having to face the consequences of his terrible actions. Can you imagine feeling this way? David has to face the fact that the blood of an innocent child was killed because of his actions. He had to face the fact that someone's husband died in battle because he wanted it to happen. He had to face the fact that he dishonored Bathsheba. The consequences of his actions were right in front of him, and he had to face them all as brutally and honestly as one possibly could. So then after that, everything just starts going drastically downhill. And we read of the story of Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom. Tamar was David's daughter, and Amnon was David's son, as was Absalom. And Amnon wanted to be with Tamar so bad that he fell ill for her. He began to develop feelings for Tamar, and then he fell ill because he wanted to be with her so badly. And so Jonadab, Amnon's friend and David's nephew, he crafted a plan to get Tamar into Amnon's room. And so Amnon sends a servant to go ask David if Tamar could come in and make cakes for him and feed him food. And so David tells Tamar to go do that. And she comes into the room, and Amnon grabs her and says to sleep with me. And Tamar says, "Why would you want to violate me like this? It's embarrassing for me and it's shameful, but also it's embarrassing for you and you're going to look like a fool in the nation of Israel." But he didn't care. And so he sleeps with her and he violates her. And then Tamar gets up and he's so angry with her that he casts her out of the room. And she says, "You're going to dishonor me even more just by sending me out." And he doesn't care. He's so mad that he just sends her out of the room. So Absalom hears about this. And Absalom is obviously upset. And he's angry with Amnon, his brother, for doing this. Tamar went and lived with Absalom and lived a lonely life after that. And Absalom waited 2 years. It says that he did not say one good or bad thing to Amnon. He didn't say anything to Amnon about what happened or how he felt. It just said that he waited 2 years. Now, there's an important detail here in verse 21. It says, when King David had heard of all these things, he was very angry. And that's all we hear from King David. For the rest of this part of the story, David doesn't do anything. He's just mad. And I can't imagine, especially, I mean, I'm not a parent, but assuming that I was, if this were to happen to my daughter, I cannot imagine I would just be angry and that be it. Like, I would have to do something, especially if it was someone that I could discipline, especially if I was a king. And it just says that David was angry. The man that killed Saul's messenger, the man that the great king of Israel, there's no punishment for the people in his own family again. Why doesn't David punish the people in his family? Do you think that he might realize that maybe this is his fault for displeasing the Lord? Do you think maybe he's thinking of those phrases of the sword will never depart from your house and I will bring out evil from your own home, your own household? Do you think maybe that's what he's thinking, and he's thinking, this is my fault? So Absalom, he waits 2 whole years. He's angry for 2 years. And he invites David to this feast after 2 years. And he pretty much knows that David's not going to want to go, but he wants to make it sound important by inviting David first, the king. So David says, I really don't want to go, no. And so Absalom says, well, can I bring Amnon? Amnon would be good to come to this feast. And David's like, why do you want Amnon? But Absalom just kept going. He said, just let me bring Amnon. So David allows it. And Amnon comes with him to the feast. And so Absalom tells all of David's servants that were there, hey, we're going to kill Amnon. Hear me out. This is a good thing. Just trust me on this. We're going to kill Amnon. And so he says, when I say the word, you go up there and you kill him. And so that's what happened. Absalom said whatever word, and then Amnon was dead. David hears the news of Amnon. And this guy says, all the king's sons are dead. I thought this was funny. He says, all the king's sons are dead. And then they have kind of a discourse about it where they talk. And at the end of it, he says, and by all the king's sons, I really just mean Amnon. And I don't know why this happens. I just thought it was funny. But Amnon has died. And David's, of course, he's really upset. Absalom flees to his grandfather's house. And David and his household mourns the loss of Amnon. But again, Absalom doesn't really receive any punishment. He stays in this other land for, I believe, 3 years. And then in verse 39, at the end of this chapter, it says that the spirit of the Lord longed to go out to Absalom. I'm sorry, the spirit of David longs to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. Not that David really wanted to go see him, but that he didn't really want to kill him anymore. Like he was okay now. But still, again, there's no punishment. And then chapter 14, David allows Absalom to return to Jerusalem. And Joab gets this woman to go to the throne of David and tell a parable of sorts to convince David to allow him to return. And David figures out what's happening, and he's like, Joab, why don't you just talk to me about this? And so Joab does, and he ends up allowing Absalom to return. And he allows him to come back into the king's presence, but I ask why. Is David reminded of his wrongs when he sees Absalom? Because he said, I misworded, he said that Absalom could come back to Jerusalem, but he could not be in the king's presence. So that's what makes me question why. Like, does David see Absalom and think of what he did wrong and think about how the Lord, what the Lord told him, and think about his own faults? And he just doesn't want to see Absalom. Because I feel like if David was really upset about this, then he would have killed Absalom, or he would have kept him away, and he could have stayed in his own house and just never came near David, but he allowed him back. So Absalom gets Joab's attention after a few years of staying there by burning his fields, and then Joab's like, why did you do this? And Absalom said, well, I just really need to talk to you. And he said, I want to go into David's presence, and if he finds me guilty and I die, then I die. That's okay. So he went into David's presence, and David bowed to him, and he kissed him. And David's not still mad at Absalom. Why keep him so away so long if you missed him so much? Is it really punishment? And then we see Absalom. At the end of chapter 14, it says that Absalom was like the most attractive person in all of the land. And this plays into chapter 15. Oh, I'm sorry. That was in chapter 15 where this happens. But anyways, he devised this plan to win over all of the people of Israel. And so these people are coming in and they're upset. And anyone that has a dispute, Absalom goes and he finds them before he gets to the throne, before they get to the throne. And he says, oh, what's wrong? And they're like, well, we've got this dispute and we have to go talk to David about it. And he's like, yeah, man, if only there was like someone to really talk to about this, that would get this done. Like, maybe if you like trusted in me, then maybe we could get this done. And then people start following him. They're like, yeah, let's follow Absalom. He's going to take care of us, and he's going to handle these disputes for us. And then before long, it's spreading, this movement of Absalom over King David. And before long, everyone is following Absalom. And so David hears about this, and this servant comes and reaches out to David, and he said that the hearts of Israel are all now with Absalom. And so how does David feel? At this point, he allows Absalom to come back. He accepts him back into his presence. He shows him love. And now he's shocked. He's betrayed. Was he just waiting for this to happen, knowing that evil would come out of his home? David flees the throne, and he escapes Jerusalem before his own son kills him. And David ascends into the Mount of Olives with all of his men and servants, except for 10 concubines that he left at home. But he walks up the Mount of Olives barefoot with his head covered. Even David's advisor had begun helping Absalom and just kind of kicked David while he's down with the news. But what's on David's mind during this walk? You ever go on a walk to clear your head? You think through life when things get difficult. Maybe you're really anxious and you start pacing back and forth. I imagine it being quiet. Nobody wants to talk while David is walking. It's somber. I imagine it's humiliating for David to have to do this with his head covered and he's barefoot. And he's walking along this path and people are looking at him from left and right from different towns and cities and thinking, that was my king. And now his son has taken his throne. And so he's walking. David's loyal men are probably questioning what's happened. David's gone from being one of the greatest kings, the greatest king ever. Granted, there was only two. But he ends up being one of the greatest kings that Israel had ever had, if not the greatest. God was on his side. He was winning every battle he was in. He had a large family, and it all came crashing down because of his wrongs. God said, the sword will not leave your family. I will raise an evil within your family. And after what happened with Uriah and Bathsheba, do you think that this is on his mind as he's walking, his wrong of what he did with Bathsheba and Uriah? So what's on the mind of David? Is it that he shouldn't let Absalom back? That was just a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. Or is it that he should have punished Amnon before Absalom had to kill him? Maybe he should have just punished Amnon and then this never would have happened with Absalom. Or is it that he should have been a better father and a better example to his children? He's beating himself up for the things that he did was wrong and what they saw in him. Or is it that what God said after Nathan came to him and revealed the consequences of his actions with Uriah and Bathsheba? David has to face his failure as a father in the home, as a leader in his household and in his nation, and he had to face the fact that he displeased the Lord on this walk. Have you ever taken a walk like this? Maybe not to this magnitude, but similar feelings. Maybe I'm a failure. What kind of example have I been? What kind of Christian am I that I would do such a thing that I've done? Does God even still love me? Am I worthy of love? David's going on this kind of walk. So we see Mephibosheth's betrayal. Ziba comes to him and in verses 1 through 4, right before the text, and he comes to him and he says, I brought these two donkeys so that David can still ride like a king. And I brought all these provisions and foods, and this was all my idea. Mephibosheth actually is trying to take the throne now because it's rightfully his. And so this is his, like, time to shine is what he's saying. I don't know, but this was my idea to bring all of this stuff to you. Please look upon me nice. It's pretty much what's happening. It was all of his accord and his own idea. And so David says that he tells Ziba that whatever Mephibosheth had, all of his possessions, they're now yours. For one, David's being betrayed by a man he was so nice to. He didn't have to be. But he purposefully and very intentionally went and found him and was nice to him. And then two, he tells Ziba, you can just have everything Mephibosheth had. Now, does he really know like if Ziba's telling the truth. You can't know. I don't think so. He's just taking Ziba at his word. But David judges quickly because he's already so far in this valley, so low, that I really don't think it even matters to him that much. I don't think that he really cares, because if he did, he'd probably wait until he got back and to see if it was actually true what Ziba said. But at this point, he's barefoot with his head covered, walking down the Mount of Olives or up the Mount of Olives, and he says, "You can just have everything. Just take it." So then we get to the point where Shimei throws rocks. And in the beginning, Shimei introduces himself to David in one of the worst times of his entire life. David's walking down this path, thinking of all these things. His mind's probably in a terrible place, and he's barefoot with his head covered, and that's when Shimei comes and starts throwing rocks. And in verses 6 through 8, we learn a lot about Shimei. First, things we know about Shimei is that he was the son of Gera. He's prominent in the household of Saul. He's from the town of Bahurim in Benjamin, which had some David supporters, but also, obviously, people that didn't like David. Is located on the north side of the Mount of Olives. And what else do we know? Why was he throwing rocks? That's one of the first things that came to mind. I was like, why throw rocks? Isn't that kind of elementary? Like, little kids, like, pick up and throw rocks. Like, I don't know why. Like, you're not going to hurt David or kill him just by throwing some rocks, especially with all this his mighty men around. Like, are you wanting to die? He's grieving. He's angry. See, Shimei, he blames David for the death of Abner and Ishbosheth, for sure. But he also is likely blaming him, or he could be angry, because the death of Saul and Jonathan and all of Saul's sons and grandsons that have died. And during these times of anger and grieving, it causes irrational and illogical thoughts and actions. As hard as David tried to be clear of these murders and respect the household of David when he became king, Shimei still blames him. And it would do David no good to stand up there and to explain to him what happened, and to stop him from throwing rocks and saying, no, I actually was really nice to the household of Saul, and I actually really respected them for what happened, because it wouldn't matter. Shimei lost people in his family, and no logic or reasoning from David is going to change the fact that Shimei is hurting. No explanation will help. So this is not to say that Shimei is a good person and he just experienced some pain. Shimei is not a very good person, but he's hurting. And at this point, we can conclude that Shimei doesn't care about his life, because in Exodus 22:28, it says that cursing a king is deserving of death, and he's asking for death. He's cursing at King David. He's throwing rocks at him. The pain he's facing is greater than his own desire to live. And so Shimei calls David both a man of blood, and he calls him worthless. I think these words hurt a lot more than the rocks do. After this walk, David's probably doubting himself. He's been thinking. Do you think he's reminded of the promise that was made to him of the eternal kingdom, and maybe wondering if he had messed that up, thinking, God doesn't want me for this. I'm not fit for this. I'm a failure. He's being called the man of blood. Shimei means it, referring to his relatives, the people in his family that had died. But what do you think David's thinking about? He might be thinking about that. But do you think he's thinking about the baby, the innocent baby that had died in the 7 days that he laid face down? Or do you think he's thinking about Amnon or all of the innocent blood that was shed because of his sinful actions? He's being called worthless in a time when he probably doesn't feel like he's worth much at all. So you continue on, and the story of Abishai is ready to jump into action because of his offenses. And he calls Shimei a dead dog. Mephibosheth uses that for humility, to show humility. Abishai is using it to show his irrelevance, Shimei's irrelevance, and as an insult. And so David and Abishai, they disagree on what happens. David knows that it would be catastrophic to kill Shimei, and he doesn't know why this is happening. He says, why would I ask why? But he doesn't really care why either. And so in verses 11 and 12, we see something that David says that's really important. In verse 11, and David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. David trusts in God's providence. And when you trust in God's will, you don't need to ask why things are happening, but much more so, how should you react to those things? Can David say with full confidence that this punishment is from the Lord, and the Lord's just at work through Shimei? I don't know. But it could be punishment, and David could completely be right, and David is willing to endure this punishment. But the fact that he even thinks it's punishment from God tells me that he's probably thinking about all the wrongs he's done, and the things that he's done that's wrong that has led up to this. with Bathsheba and Amnon and Absalom. And that's what's been on his mind during this 21-mile walk up 3,500 feet of Mount Olives. One could argue that there's probably an element of depression with David as well. I mean, David's life's in shambles. His son wants to kill him. His kingdom has turned on him. He's walking barefoot with his head covered up the Mount of Olives. And someone's throwing rocks at him. David could just be willing to accept the punishment and just add on to the hurt. Have you ever felt like that? Like, man, maybe this is my punishment. Maybe I just deserve to be punished. Just keep it coming. Like, I deserve this. Regardless of that, David still shows his trust in God and God's will, and he completely yields to God. So in verse 13, Shimei continues yelling and screaming and throwing rocks, and David just lets it happen. So let's find some applications, and then we'll close. Trusting God turns every why into how, and this is something that we talked about this past Wednesday night, I believe, in the college class with Job. But a full reliance on God and his will for us and his kingdom allows us to have peace in the fact that we don't have to always understand why. Trusting God turns whys into hows. How can I use this trial to grow stronger in my faith? How can I use this so that I can be a better servant of the kingdom? How can I find blessings in this and use those blessings for the benefit of the kingdom? David could have been asking why this was happening to him, why God was continuing to punish him while he was down, if that's what's happening. And he could have just given up. David could have said, like, you know what, just let this guy throw rocks. I'm just going to lay here. Let him kill me. He wants to kill me anyways. He could have given up on God, on his people, on his family. But instead, he just completely gave himself to God and completely yields to him. And finally, something I want to get across to you is that God can use us all in his kingdom. No matter what terrible thing you've done in your life or what has happened in your lives, no matter what terrible thing may have happened just at all in your life, God can use us in his kingdom. And it's one of the most beautiful things about God's kingdom. David was called a man of blood by Shimei. And maybe it hurt so much to David because it was true. In 2 Chronicles 28:3, we talked about that God didn't want David to build a temple, and it's partially because he was a man of war. He had blood on his hands, and he did not want David to be the one who built the temple. And there's a theme throughout David's life of death. He kills a lot of enemies, but he also experiences a lot of tragic deaths. He's called a man of blood, and it's a part of his identity. It's a main part of his life is taking life from others. And it has propelled him into kingship, if you remember with Goliath and all of the victories that he's won up until this point. So it's propelled him into being a great king. And God has used this quality about him, his ability in war, to benefit his kingdom. But David has to face the fact that this part of himself is also part of what caused all this to happen. A part of David that God used for the good of his kingdom, David used for wrong against Uriah. And it followed him into other parts of his life because of it. When he took control of this ability, this part of himself, instead of completely surrendering himself to God to use it for good, God said, the sword will never leave your house. If this is what you want to do, this will never leave your house. So David was a man of blood. It was a good thing when he used it for the benefit of God's kingdom, but it quickly became evil when he used it for his own selfish desires. So let's answer this question. Why have you not surrendered to God? Have you surrendered yourself to God? What can you do that you haven't been doing for the kingdom? What part of your life are you failing to give to him? Are you holding something back because of your own desires? Is there something that was a part of the old man that should have died when the new one rose out of the water? If you haven't surrendered yourself fully to God and what he can do with you, then what are you waiting on? What's holding you back from fully surrendering to our Father and our Creator? And if you haven't been buried with Christ and even began to surrender yourself fully, now is as good of a time as ever. God can use you in his kingdom, but you have to give yourself to him first. So if you have any need, please come as we stand and we sing.